Good afternoon. Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, May 5th. I am Dagna, and I'll be reading local news and local pandemic information. We will begin with a recap of the weather for the Sioux City area. Today will be windy with a high of 64 and a low tonight of 42. Wednesday will be windy also with some sun, with a high of 62 and a low of 38. Thursday will be occasional rain and a thunderstorm with a high of 57 and a low of 34. Friday will be sunshine and cool with a high of 58 and a low of 32. And Saturday will be increasing cloudiness with a high of 67 and a low of 40. And that's a recap for the Sioux City area for the weather for the next few days. We'll now read the mini editorial. Today, the mini editorial was written by Doug Shinsing of South Sioux City, Nebraska. And Doug writes, "Remember when the bad guys wore masks and the good guys didn't?" Again, this was written by Doug Shinsing of South Sioux City, Nebraska. Our first front page story is a headline of "Drive-Through COVID-19 Test Site Opens at Sioux City's Western Iowa Tech." And this is a story by Earl Horlick of the Sioux City Journal. And there is a photo with this story of a car, and the caption of the picture is, "A vehicle enters a tent Monday at the Test Iowa COVID-19 testing site at Western Iowa Tech Community College in Sioux City. The testing site, set up by the Iowa National Guard's Task Force West, is open to people who have been pre-approved after having taken an online assessment at testiowa.com. And our story, "A drive-through COVID-19 testing site began operations Monday on the Western Iowa Tech Community College campus in Sioux City. The site is in response to an initiative launched by Governor Kim Reynolds that encouraged Iowans to complete a novel coronavirus screening survey at testiowa.com. Based on those results, up to 3,000 tests will be administered each day at a handful of sites throughout the state, including Sioux City. The test site is only open to those with appointments through healthcare providers. The online survey asks questions about respondents' health, travel, and possible exposure to those who have the virus. Respondents also provide personal information such as birth date, place of employment, and health status, including any chronic conditions such as heart disease, anemia, or high blood pressure. The test site on the WIT campus is being staffed by medical personnel, as well as members of the Iowa Air National Guard's 185th Air Refueling Wing and the Iowa Army National Guard 234th Joint Task Force West. On Tuesday, we'll be here from noon until 6 p.m., Captain Sam Otto, the Joint Task Force Public Affairs Officer, said. Beginning Wednesday and continuing, we'll be testing people from 8 a.m. until 6 p.m. every weekday. We anticipate being here for 2 weeks. Otto added that subjects won't have to leave their vehicles for the test. They will need to bring a special quick response code through either a printout or on a cell phone. Two lanes have been set up, leading vehicles to a large tent where medical workers check temperatures and then administer swabs to collect a person's nasal passage samples. It happens very quickly, Otto said. It only takes a few minutes. Medical staff will collect the samples that will then be sent to the State Hygienic Laboratory in Coralville, Iowa for testing. Results will be returned electronically in 2 to 3 days. "We're trying to make things run as smoothly as possible," Otto said. "We're trying to get people in and out without much fuss." Second front page story headline is "Seaboard Triumph Foods Worker Dies of COVID-19. This story was written by Dolly A. Butts of the Sioux City Journal. A 56-year-old Seaboard Triumph Foods worker died of the novel coronavirus Friday at a Sioux City hospital, according to a South Sioux City imam. Ahmad Muhammad, the imam of the Islamic Center of Siouxland, said in an email Monday that the man was originally from Eritrea. He said he lived in Des Moines before coming to the Sioux City metro area 2 months ago to work at the pork plant. The man was sick for about a week. He stayed home for 4 to 5 days, and then he spent the last 2 days of his life in Mercy One Hospital in Sioux City, Muhammad wrote. The man is the first Seaboard Triumph Foods worker and the fourth Sioux City Metro meatpacking plant worker whose death has been attributed to the virus. Due to conflicting information, it is unclear what county he lived in. His death would be the third recorded in either Woodbury County or Dakota County. A spokeswoman for Seaboard Triumph Foods said she couldn't share the worker's name out of respect for next of kin. She did not address the journal's request for an updated total of workers who have tested positive for COVID-19, but issued the following statement. We are saddened to learn today of the death of an employee, and we, along with the authorities, are coordinating to find family to offer our support. We are also working with Dakota County Health Department to verify the cause of death and gather the specifics of the situation. On April 28th, the pork processor said 11 workers had tested positive for COVID-19 at its Sioux City plant. Seaboard Triumph Foods, which opened in the fall of 2017, employs around 2,400 workers. It is the second largest fresh pork plant in the world, slaughtering more than 20,000 hogs daily. Siouxland District Health Department confirmed 94 additional cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing Woodbury County's case total to 1,252. 50 of the Northwest Iowa County's residents are currently hospitalized, according to the Health Department's data. The health department announced the second COVID-19 related death of a Woodbury County resident on Saturday. The woman, who was between the ages of 61 and 80, died at her home. Dakota County reported 25 additional cases of the novel coronavirus Monday, bringing the Northeast Nebraska counties total to 1,005. It's unclear how many Dakota County residents have been hospitalized because the Dakota County Health Department has said it cannot provide those numbers. Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center and Unity Point Health St. Luke's said in a joint statement issued Monday that the two Sioux City hospitals are providing care for 83 COVID-19 patients. We are committed to protecting the privacy of our patients and cannot provide specific details regarding any individual patient in our care. Public health officials continue to take the lead in reporting information on suspected and confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus in Siouxland, the statement said. State and local officials have been reluctant to tie the spike in cases in Woodbury and Dakota counties to the Tyson Fresh Meats plant in Dakota City. The facility, the company's largest beef plant, employs over 4,300 workers. Tyson officials have declined to say how many of its Dakota City workers have fallen ill with the virus, but an individual familiar with the situation told the Journal last Thursday that 669 of the workers had tested positive. The majority of the plant's workers live in the much more populous Woodbury County. Three Dakota City Tyson workers have succumbed to COVID-19. The first was 64-year-old Raimondo Corral of Sioux City, who died April 18th at his home. Vinexe Kunun, 69, who died April 24th at his home, was the second. The third, a South Sioux City woman in her 50s or 60s, died Friday night at a hospital. New numbers from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show nearly 600 workers across 12 meatpacking plants in Nebraska tested positive for the coronavirus in April, which is roughly 3% of the 20,000 workers employed there. In Iowa, 377 workers in just two plants tested positive, or 18.2% of those plants' workforce. Similar to coronavirus outbreaks seen in homeless shelters, prisons, hospitals, and nursing homes, the close quarters at work and crowded conditions involved in the slaughtering, slicing, and packaging of meat seem to allow the virus to spread more easily, the CDC said. But it's still unclear whether workers who are falling ill caught the virus at work or out in the community. Nationally, 4,913 workers in 115 facilities in 19 states have tested positive, and 20 have died. That's also about 3% of the 130,000 workers in those plants. The Dakota County Health Department, in a statement released Monday, urged residents to stay home, avoid non-essential errands, refrain from social gatherings, and respect the 10-person limit. The health department also asked residents to work from home or socially distance at work, only shop alone once a week, have their kids play at home, help seniors stay at home, and refrain from visiting long-term care centers. The statement said residents are also encouraged to exercise daily and do their best to stay healthy. Our last front page story headline is Tyson delays reopening of Dakota City beef plant to wait for COVID-19 test results. And this story was written by Dave Driesen of the Sioux City Journal. Dakota City, Nebraska. Tyson Fresh Food Meats on Monday postponed the reopening of its Dakota City beef plant as a meat packer awaited complete results of the COVID-19 test for its workers. Tyson said in a statement Monday afternoon, "The health and safety of our team members is our top priority, and we take this responsibility extremely seriously. We continue to work through processing the large amount of testing data for our 4,300 team members, and therefore have decided to temporarily delay the reopening of our Dakota City facility. We are notifying team members with report to for work instructions based on an individual's test results and care, and will provide additional updates on our revised reopening timeline shortly. The plant, which has been idle since Friday, had been scheduled to restart production on Tuesday. As of Thursday, 669 workers at the plant had tested positive for COVID-19, a source familiar with the situation told the Journal. Tyson has finished testing all of its Dakota City workers for the novel coronavirus, a company spokesperson said. The Nebraska National Guard assisted at the special test site. Three of the five Metro Sioux City residents to die from the virus were Dakota City plant workers. The Springdale, Arkansas-based company has acknowledged some employees testing positive for the virus, but has repeatedly refused to disclose a number of cases. State and county health officials also have repeatedly sidestepped questions about whether the plant is linked to a recent spike in novel coronavirus cases in the metro area. During a conference call with reporters on Monday, Tyson Foods' Dean Banks said the company continues to believe the plant is not a focal point of infection. "We have not seen evidence of the spread being any different than in the rest of the community," said Banks, who noted the company has been working closely with local and state health officials. The plant, Tyson's largest beef facility, is easily the metro area's largest employer. Moving off the front page, we're moving to other Siouxland stories. There is a picture that shows a long line of cars, and the picture was taken by Tim Hines of the Sioux City Journal. And the caption on the picture is, "A person directs traffic at the Norm Waite Senior YMCA in South Sioux City, Nebraska, as hundreds of cars queue up to get free eggs distributed there on Monday. The YMCA has hosted several food giveaways in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic." And then another story is, "A coronavirus response, not political, Iowa Governor Reynolds says." And this was written by Aaron Murphy, who's at the Des Moines Bureau for the Journal. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said her decisions leading the state's response to the global COVID-19 pandemic are some of the hardest she has made as a governor, and that they are not politically motivated, but based on data and metrics. Reynolds described her decision-making process as she has lessened some mitigation efforts in 77 of the state's 99 counties, while virus-related cases and hospitalizations continue to increase, largely in the 22 counties that remain under stricter mitigation orders. During her daily briefing on the state's pandemic response efforts, Reynolds was asked how she weighs political pressure and considerations when making decisions on how to address the virus and its spread. "This isn't political. It's about trying to do the right thing in an unprecedented time," Reynolds said, adding that she bases her decisions on data, metrics, and the expertise of her administrative staff at the state's public health department and federal government. "I feel very confident in the information that they're providing me." Reynolds called the decisions she has made, including those to cancel the remainder of the school year and order many business partially or entirely closed, "some of the hardest decisions I've had to make as governor of this great state." The state on Monday confirmed four additional deaths as a result of the COVID-19. That is the lowest single-day total in nearly 2 weeks. The state also confirmed 534 new cases. That number has generally increased over the past week as the state's testing efforts have ramped up. Hospitalizations continue to increase, although they also continue to be mostly contained in the areas of the state where the virus is more widespread. There were 389 virus-related hospitalizations reported Monday by state public health officials, a new single-day high. But of those, 354 were in the hardest-hit areas of the state, eastern and central Iowa, plus Woodbury County. The headline for the next story is, Onawa teen pleads not guilty to sexual abuse. Story written by Nick Hytrek of the Sioux City Journal. An Onawa teenager charged with fatally shooting another teen has pled not guilty to sexually assaulting 7 girls. J. Lee Newbaum, 17, entered his written plea Friday in Monona County District Court to 7 counts of third-degree sexual abuse. A trial date has not been set. According to court documents, Newbaum is accused of raping 6 teenage girls and forcing sexual contact with the 7th. The girls ranged in age from 13 to 16. The alleged incidents occurred in September, November, February, and March in Mapleton, Iowa. Witnesses told authorities that Newbaum forced sexual contact with teenage girls, ranging from kissing and groping to sexual intercourse, court documents said. Newbaum repeatedly denied ever having sex or engaging in sexual activity with the girls or any other person during an interview with investigators. Newbaum is scheduled to stand trial in August for first-degree murder for the January 31st shooting death of 16-year-old Joseph Hopkins in a garage in the 300 block of South 5th Street in Mapleton. According to court documents, Newbaum became angry with Hopkins because he and another teen were not stopped playing with an unloaded shotgun. Newbaum retrieved a loaded shotgun from the demolition derby car in which they were working and fired a single shot, striking Hopkins in the head, court documents said. Newbaum's attorney is seeking to have him tried as a juvenile rather than as an adult in both cases. A hearing on that matter is scheduled for June 1st. Newbaum has posted bond in both cases and has been released from custody. Our next story headline, Sioux City man arrested after shots fired. A Sioux City man was arrested Sunday night after reports of shots fired in a mid-city neighborhood. Jason A. Motto, 26, was charged with discharging a weapon in city limits, carrying a weapon, and 2 felony counts of possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver. Based upon information provided by witnesses, officers determined Mota had fired the shots at a residence on the 1600 block of Jackson Street at around 9:36 p.m. Sunday. Officers obtained a search warrant at Mota's house and seized several firearms, drugs, and drug paraphernalia. Police say no one was injured and no residents were struck during this incident. Our next story, Dakota County tables action on wind farm moratorium. The story is written by Nick Hytrek of the Sioux City Journal. Dakota County leaders have decided more study and public input is needed before voting on a moratorium on wind farm developments. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners on Monday voted 4-0 to table a resolution that would have prohibited wind energy developers from building in the county. Commissioner Tony Gomez was absent. Commissioners agreed that because of restrictions in place to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus, the ability for county citizens to provide input has been limited. The Dakota County Courthouse is currently closed to the public, except by appointment, and people also are choosing to stay home in order to limit their potential exposure to COVID-19. Commissioner Janet Gill said, "In light of the current situation, we didn't think it was prudent to make a decision without more public input and more research." The subject of a moratorium arose earlier this year while the county updated its zoning ordinances governing wind energy systems. The resolution considered Monday said that the board has deemed it necessary to impose a moratorium after considering public information provided during public hearings on the zoning amendments. County officials have said they have not been approached by wind energy developers about building a wind farm in Dakota County. Gill said the board recognized on Monday that visits to wind farms like the Rattlesnake Creek Project in neighboring Dixon County and more discussions with other counties that have wind farms would be beneficial before making a decision. I think everybody's positive about clean energy, but we definitely want to make sure our residents are safe. We need to do some more research. We don't have all the facts we need, Gill said. When those visits and public meetings might take place depends on when people now taking virus-related precautions feel more comfortable about moving around and attending meetings. The board's decision was applauded by Josh Moaning, director of New Power Nebraska, a renewable energy development organization that promotes and develops wind energy projects. The Norfolk, Nebraska mayor, Moaning, participated in the meeting via teleconference. I think it's the right call, he said in a statement emailed to the journal. This decision requires a fair, full hearing in order for public officials to have the benefit of all perspectives. There are several examples of Nebraska counties today realizing the significant economic benefits of new business investment in clean energy generation. Dakota County Clerk Joan Spencer said three county residents addressed the board Monday on the moratorium. Two spoke in favor of it, and the third was neutral, Spencer said. We'll now move to the opinion page. There are no letters to the editor today, but there is our weekly Tuesday topic. Today's Tuesday topic is written by Dolph Ivener, who is a Sioux City businessman and a Northwest Iowa farmer. And his topic is Cover Crop Flexibility Act. And the headline is Cover Crop Flexibility Act Deserves Support. And Dolph writes, for the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, the nation took to recycling, gardening, and responsible climate action. However, I would like to further echo the actions taken by a local high school trap team to plant cover crops near Elk Point, South Dakota. As a Siouxland farmer and owner of Hog Power Energy, I believe the steps must be taken to reduce climate change while supporting our economy. Through technology and innovation, farming has seen changes to improve crop yield while also making changes to support sustainability. One such change that is currently in Congress is the Cover Crop Flexibility Act of 2020. The bill was introduced by Senators John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, and Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat from Michigan, to help farmers recover from turbulent growing seasons by allowing them to harvest or graze cover crops without penalty. Cover crops offer a great way for farmers to improve their soil while also practicing climate conservation. In fact, cover crops offer a better carbon sink than soil does, while providing farmers solutions for when they experience some of the wet planting conditions like much of the Midwest struggled with last year. With Senators Thune and Stabenow creating legislation that supports the agriculture sector, its farmers and communities will see more success for the planting season and better conservation. Legislation like this will not only support South Dakota and Michigan, but it will also benefit the farming community in the entire Siouxland area, including Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska. Furthermore, during a time like this, where now more than ever farmers are helping to feed the nation, by supporting the farming community, farmers can provide the crops to feed families and livestock. Food security is a bipartisan issue. As shown by the support given to the Cover Crop Flexibility Act of 2020 from both Democrats and Republicans. Because this bill has a lot to offer for the Siouxland area farming community, it is important that Senators Chuck Grassley, Joni Ernst, Deb Fisher, and Ben Sass support this legislation and help our farmers support themselves and the climate. As we look back and celebrate 50 years of Earth Day, it is important to remember the improvements we have made for our environment while also working to become better, both for the environment and with our industries. Again, this Tuesday topic was written by Dolph Ivener, who is a Sioux City businessman and a Northwest Iowa farmer. I will also read from the opinion page the quote of the day, which is written by Horace Mann, who was an American educator who lived from 1796 to 1859. And the quote is, a human being is not attaining his full heights until he is educated. And today's Bible verse is from Psalm 47, verse 1. Clap your hands, all peoples. Shout to God with loud songs of joy. If you would like to write a letter to the editor or do a mini editorial, you can there's a number of ways to do that. You can call 712-293-4223, extension 4223. Or you can email at letters@siouxcityjournal.com. You could fax it to 712-279-5059. Or you could write through the post office to Opinion, The Journal, 515 Pavonia Street, Sioux City, Iowa, 51101. Now return to another COVID-19 related story. Nebraska Governor Ricketts, don't visit areas with eased rules. Nebraska relaxed some of its social distancing restrictions on Monday in the Omaha area and more than half of the state's counties. But Governor Pete Ricketts implored people who are still living in more heavily regulated areas to stay put. Ricketts asked residents in hard-hit areas such as Grand Island and Dakota City not to venture away from their regions out of concern that they might spread the coronavirus. Unlike many other states, Ricketts has imposed public safety restrictions in Nebraska on a regional basis by local public health district. The rules are designed to keep the virus from spreading so fast that it overwhelms the state's hospitals. Ricketts was asked Monday at a news conference whether he was concerned about people crossing into less restricted areas to dine out, which they are now able to do so in the Omaha area. The new lighter rules in 59 of Nebraska's 93 counties allow salons, tattoo parlors, and restaurant dining rooms to reopen with limits on the number of people that can be present. There are going to be border issues, just like there are border issues with the states, he said. But we are asking people to do the right thing and continue to stay home if your public health district's restrictions have not been loosened. Regions of Nebraska that have seen a recent surge in coronavirus cases are still operating under tougher restrictions. Those rules prohibit restaurants from opening their dining rooms and have required salons and tattoo parlors to close. Lincoln will remain under the tougher standards until Sunday. The governor faced similar questions from constituents Monday afternoon during his monthly call-in radio show, including one concern that the effort may be self-defeating. Since the number of cases can vary widely among counties within the same public health district, people may be encouraged to travel from closed counties to open counties, undercutting their original goal. Ricketts said his administration plans to keep watch on the number of cases through May and will consider easing additional restrictions. His comments came as two more COVID-19 deaths were reported in Nebraska, bringing the state's death total to 78. The Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services said the two deaths it reported late Sunday occurred in south-central Nebraska's Dawson County. Also on Sunday, Holt County in north-central Nebraska reported its first confirmed case of the virus. Nebraska saw its number of confirmed cases soar to nearly 6,000 by Monday morning, jumping from 4,838 confirmed cases on Friday. The actual number of infections is thought to be far higher than the number of confirmed cases, though, because many people have not been tested and studies suggest that people can be infected without feeling sick. For most people, the coronavirus causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever or cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, May 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. Linda Ray Lander, 77, of Galveston, formerly of Onawa, passed away peacefully on April 27th at home after a brief illness. A celebration of life will be held in Onawa, Iowa, late this summer at a date yet to be determined. Linda was born on November 5th, 1942, in Hornick. She spent her childhood in Onawa and married Benjamin Lander in 1959. Linda worked at IBP as a key punch operator after she and the girls moved to Homer, Nebraska in 1969. Linda yearned to see the country and expand her horizons, so she moved to Salem, Oregon in 1980 and began working for Winco Foods, where she subsequently met her soulmate, Lee Goss. Linda and Lee loved the outdoors and spent time camping, fishing, going to the coast, or working in the garden. They then moved to Idaho for a few years, and after retirement, on to Texas to be closer to her daughters. In 2007, they moved to Onawa to be nearer to her siblings and classmates. Winters were spent in Lake Havasu, Arizona, where they enjoyed time spent with the many friends they met, going to the doggy park, playing pickleball, and especially taking trips to Las Vegas. After losing Lee, Linda moved to Galveston and made friends quickly at her independent living facility and enjoyed the warmer weather, walks on the beach, and spending time with family. Linda will be missed for her humor and wit, a beautiful smile, her honesty and integrity, and her willingness to always help those in need. She was charitable, loyal, loving, and a joy to be around. Linda was a proud and patriotic American and would have liked any donations to be given to the Monona County Veterans Museum. Brad F. Mickey, North Sioux City, 66, died Saturday, May 2nd. Private service at a later date. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City in charge of arrangements. Herbert H. Foster of Mobile, 70, died Sunday, May 3rd. Arrangements by Nicholas D. Jensen, Funeral Home of Mobile. Gary E. Schultz, Sioux City, 77, died Sunday, May 3rd. Arrangements by Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Lorraine R. Henning, 92, of Mobile, died Saturday, May 2nd. At Whispering Creek Retirement Community in Sioux City. Due to the COVID-19 virus, a private service will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at Morningside Chapel, Christy Smith Funeral Homes. Burial will be in Gilman Township Cemetery in Ashton, Iowa. The ceremony will be live-streamed on Leon DeJong's Facebook page. Lorraine Ruth Feldman, the daughter of Reinhard and Louisa Valpool Feldman, was born on November 28, 1927 in Ashton. She was educated in a country school and graduated from George Community High School. On November 5, 1949, Lorraine was united in marriage with Alvin Rowdy Henning in Sioux City. She was employed as an office manager and administrative assistant for the Woodbury County REC for 37 years. She worked for Novelty Machine for the next 5 years. Rowdy died on October 24, 2016. Lorraine was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church in Mobile, Meadows Country Club, the Garden Club, Smile, and the Red Hat Society. She enjoyed ceramics in her spare time. The couple had also wintered in Apache Junction, Arizona since 1985. The family has requested that memorials be directed to Hospice of Siouxland. Herbert H. Henges, Jefferson, South Dakota, 86, died Monday, May 4th. Arrangements by Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Dennis Denny Punt, Orange City, Iowa, 85, died Sunday, May 3rd. Private service will be May 7th at 10:30 a.m. Burial will be at the West Lawn Cemetery, Orange City. Visitation May 6th, 3 to 8 p.m. Arrangements by Ullman Funeral Home, Orange City. J.C. Jean Hermstead, Spencer, Iowa, formerly of Storm Lake, 26, died Friday, May 1st. Private service May 8th. Celebration of life at a later date. Burial at Storm Lake Cemetery. Arrangements by Fransky and Jensen Funeral Home of Storm Lake. And that concludes obituaries for today, Tuesday, May 5th. So we'll now move back to some other local stories. This one is from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Meatpackers cautiously reopened plants amid coronavirus fears. A South Dakota pork processing plant took its first steps towards reopening on Monday after being shuttered for over 2 weeks because of a coronavirus outbreak that infected more than 800 employees. Employees reporting for work in Smithfield's Food Ground Pork Department filed through a tent where they were screened for fever and other signs of COVID-19. Some said they felt the measures Smithfield has taken would protect them from another virus outbreak, while others were not confident that infections could be halted in a crowded plant. Lydia Toby said she was kind of worried as she entered the plant before 6 a.m. for her first shift in over 2 weeks. Managers met employees in her department Friday and explained they had installed dividers on the production line and would require everyone to wear masks. "I think it's going to be okay," Toby said. In the wake of an executive order from President Donald Trump ordering meat plants to remain open, Arkansas-based Tyson Foods was also resuming limited production Monday at its pork plant in Logan's Point, Indiana, where nearly 900 employees tested positive. And the JBS pork plant in Worthington, Minnesota, just an hour east of Smithfield's South Dakota plant and 90 minutes north of Sioux City, planned a partial reopening on Wednesday. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden on Monday called meatpacking plants, along with nursing homes, the most dangerous places there are right now. He called for greater protections for meatpacking workers, as well as a $13 an hour pay premium. "They designate them as essential workers and then treat them as disposable," Biden said on a conference call about protecting essential workers, such as meatpacking workers, that was organized by the League of United Latin American Citizens. Virginia-based Smithfield is offering COVID-19 testing to all employees and their family members, according to a text message sent to employees. The message told employees to report to a local high school to be tested. Governor Kristi Noem said employees aren't required to undergo tests before returning to work, though it's strongly encouraged. Noem's health commissioner, Kim Molson-Ryson, said it was Smithfield's decision to make the test optional. Smithfield didn't respond to requests for comments. About 250 employees were told to report to work on Monday, according to the union that represents them. The plant employs about 3,700 workers and produces roughly 5% of the nation's pork. Saladin Ahmed, who works in a department that has not yet reopened, said he was called in by plant management to look at changes. "They fixed a lot of things," he said, describing how workers would be spread apart where possible. A Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report Friday said more than 4,900 workers at meat and poultry processing facilities have been diagnosed with the coronavirus, including 20 who died. Not all states provided data. That's all of the Siouxland interest stories, area stories that we have for today. I'm going to move into the sports section, and there are no local stories on that, but there is a section today called Memory Lane, This Day in Sports History, and that just kind of gives a few things that have happened in the past. So in 2017, for sports history, Corey Perry scored 6 minutes into the second overtime after the NHL's Anaheim Ducks rallied from a 3-goal deficit in the final minutes of regulations, completing a spectacular 4-3 comeback over the Edmonton Oilers in Game 5 of the Western Conference semifinal series. And 1904, Cy Young of the Boston Red Sox pitched a perfect game against the Philadelphia Athletics. 1969, led by player-coach Bill Russell, the Boston Celtics beat the Los Angeles Lakers 107-102 in the seventh game to win the NBA championship for the 10th time in 11 years. In 1973, Secretariat, ridden by Ron Turcotte, won the Kentucky Derby with a record time of 1:59.2. Secretariat beat Sham by 2.5 lengths and went on to win the Triple Crown. 1978, Pete Rose became the 14th player with 3,000 hits when he singled against Montreal's Steve Rogers. 1993, Canisius beat Niagara 11-1 in softball to set an NCAA Division I record with 34 consecutive wins. 2007, Floyd Mayweather Jr. beat Oscar De La Hoya in one of the richest fights ever. Mayweather, using his superb defensive skills and superior speed, won a 12-round split decision and took the WBC 154-pound title in his first fight at that weight. The sellout crowd of 16,000 at the MGM Grand Garden in Las Vegas set a record $19 million gate. And in 2018, Justify splashed through the slop to win the Kentucky Derby by 2.5 lengths, becoming the first colt in 136 years to wear the roses after not racing as a 2-year-old. And another sports trivia, digging deeper into history. Home runs by a catcher. Mike Piazza set a major league mark for homers as a catcher on May 5th, 2004, hitting number 352 in the New York Mets 8-2 victory over the San Francisco Giants. And that basically concludes everything that's in the paper, the Sioux City Journal today, for local stories of interest and some trivia, sports trivia. So I'm going to move, for the few minutes that I have left, I'm going to move to a magazine. It's the May issue of Real Simple. And they have a section in there about what mom has told me. With Mother's Day coming up this coming Sunday, I thought that might be interesting if we read some of these things that people have said. The first one is Padma Lashkma, who's the host of Top Chef. She said her mother told her, "Cooking is about nourishment, both physical and spiritual. We cook for people because we want to feed them. So don't worry about being perfect. Your time is better spent in their company than in the kitchen fretting over every detail." The next one is, the person is Dory Greenspan, who's a James Beard Award winner for cooking. And she said her mother told her, "Never order lobster or chicken on a first date. Too messy." Our next one is from a restaurant owner named James Brisconi. And his mom said, "A good chef always cleans up after himself. She told me this over and over when I was a teenager. Granted, she likely gave me this advice because she didn't want to clean up after me. But it has served me remarkably well in my career." The next one is from Jessica Batalana, who is author of a cookbook. And she says, "Appreciate the ordinary joy of gathering around a table with people you love." And the next one is from Marcella Valladolid, who's also a chef, and said, "No food is bad or good. What's made with love is good for you and your soul." Now we'll move from the cooking, the chefs and that, to other people. And this next one is Rachel Ray, who does happen to be a chef, but she's also a TV personality. And her mother said, "Take your work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously." She always says that work of any kind is a privilege. And the most important thing is to have a sense of humor about yourself. And then this next one is Megan MacArthur, and is what she says she tells other moms. "Ask for help when you need it. There may be natural mothers out there, super moms who always know the right thing to do, but I'm not one of them." And then here's one from a fashion designer and a mother of one, and she says what she tells her daughter. "Treat every day as if it's special. I tell my daughter that she should wear her favorite piece, an oversized leopard print cardigan, as often as possible and not to save it for a special occasion. Beautiful clothing should be worn often because of the magical way it makes you feel." Here's one from Lauren Conrad, who is a fashion designer. And she says, "My mother always dressed in clean, classic pieces, and that influences the way I dress today. I take chances now and then, but I always feel most put together in simple, well-fitting garments in neutral colors." And that would be because of the influence of her mother. It was another one who's her name is Melanie Heiberger, who is the co-founder of a hosiery brand. And her mother told her, "Don't dream your life, live your life." She said it so many times when I was growing up that I even wrote it down on a vision board I keep on my desk. I repeat it to myself when I'm getting ready for a big event. And now we're moving on to person is Melissa Maker, who's a founder of Clean My Space. And her mother told her, "Be environmentally friendly." She made it important to our family before it was a hot topic. We recycled, shut lights off when not in use, and were mindful of not overconsuming and creating a ton of waste. Now, this one is written by Rebecca Atwood, who is a designer. Her mother said, "My mom taught me to always use the good stuff. That meant using nice china and real silver on a daily basis. Why have it if it sits in the cabinet most of the year?" And this next one is from Leslie Corona, who is a senior association associate editor at this magazine. And her mother said, "Never buy anything full price. My mom will find a coupon for anything under the sun to avoid paying full price." And the next one is from Justina Blankney, who is a designer. And her mother said, "My mother has always celebrated and taught me about the beauty of different cultures. Because of her, I love to incorporate things from diverse cultures into my space." This next quote is from Joanna Goddard, who's a creator of the website A Cup of Joe. And she tells her kids, "We value you. To show them, we have family photos everywhere. A big gallery in the living room, snapshots taped up in the kitchen, and framed pictures in our bedrooms." And the next one is from Julie Bestry, who is an organizer. And her mother said, "Store like with like. When I was small, my mother found my shoes in the middle of the floor. So she picked them up and proceeded to have a one-sided conversation, soothing the crying shoes and apologizing for my abandoning them so far from their shoe families in the closet. Certainly, the lesson was vivid." The next one is from Becky Rapinchuk, who's the founder of Clean Mama. And she tells her kids, "Every day, do a little something. I teach them we have to clean up after ourselves daily. Then they aren't overwhelmed by disaster bedrooms." Next one is from Donna Smallen Cooper, who is a house cleaning technician. And her mother said, "Sweep the kitchen floor every night after doing dishes. Then turn off the lights and close the kitchen. Not only can you go longer between moppings, it's good for your waistline." Our next one is from Tanya Nayak, who's a designer. And her mother said, "Great design doesn't need to cost a fortune, as long as it reflects who you are. That's what makes it special. Oh, and make your bed every day." Our next one is from Emily Henderson, who's a designer. And her mother said, "My mom and dad publicly praised each other every day and taught us to do the same. Doesn't your mother make the best stroganoff?" Or, "Kids, I love your mother so much." And mom would always say, "You have the best dad in the world. My husband and I absolutely do this. I think it makes the kids feel really safe and create such a positive vibe in our house." And the next one is Farnoosh Torabi, who is a host of money shows. "I tell my kids, I like to teach my young children to always be financially curious. I want to communicate to them that being interested in money and wanting to talk about it is both normal and healthy." Our next one is written by Mally Roncall, who's a makeup artist. And her mother told her, "Live every day as if it were your last. My mother was diagnosed with cancer before I turned one, and they gave her 6 months to live. By the grace of God, she lived until I was 17. Every day I watched her faith, power, strong will, and passion for life. She was super glam too. I remember watching her get ready. She taught me how to do makeup. She's my muse to this day." The next one is from Dendy Engelman, who's a doctor, a surgeon. Her mother said, "It's not about how you look, it's how you feel about how you look. For me, this plays a huge role. Skincare and beauty rituals give me joy. I absolutely love baths, serums, and makeup. Were it not for her teaching, I might feel bad about it or deny myself such indulgences. But because of her, I recognize it as part of who I am and deem it an integral part of my self-care." And the next one is from Helen Marmer, who's also a doctor. And she tells her kids, "Don't get mired in comparing yourself with others. I want my kids to laugh and play and to open their minds to this incredible world we live in and make it a better place." Our next one is from Sarah Frey, who's an author and a farmer. And her mother said, "Remember that not everyone will love your children like you will. So make the extra effort to raise them in a way that the world will love. Raise good humans." And then probably the last one for today is from Catherine Suki, who's the Executive Vice President of Design. And her mother said, "It's about how your clothes fit, forget the number. Every August, we went back to school shopping, and she encouraged me to choose anything to express myself, color on color on color, and to bring those items into the fitting room in multiple sizes. I not only tried all sizes, but also followed my mom's commands to sit, squat, and walk to make sure the fit was spot on. These department store calisthenics were deeply embarrassing, but my clothes sure did fit right. Remember, no one sees the number but you, and a great fitting garment will always be more figure flattering than a size 6 you have to squeeze into. Well, and that concludes reading out of that Real Simple magazine. I thought with Mother's Day coming up and not too many stories in the Sioux City Journal today that it might be appropriate to read some of those. That does conclude the reading today for the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, May 5th. I'm Dagna, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for Frenchmen and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around Little Gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, The Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory, communal dining hall, and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians each fall after all the crops were harvested. The feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Creston News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian village's fourth annual Fête de Mai, which included a four-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.